You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
Good morning and welcome in, and this is kind of a fun day for us. We've got Brandon Marcello, the National College Football Reporter for 24/7 Sports in here, and it's fun because Brandon, I took his job 14 years ago. Brandon and I have known each other for 19 years. We met when we were both working at the Arkansas Traveler, so Brandon, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me. The place looks a lot different.
Well, so, and to kind of give you an idea, you have probably never been to our office if you're watching this, but where we sit now used to be part of the newsroom here, and we've changed offices around and everything, but right behind this wall is actually where Brandon's desk used to be. So he kind of walked in this morning and you said, I don't really know where I am.
I was just like, it seems familiar, but everything looks completely different. There's carpet and everything now, and it was like, just very strange.
We were talking about what Whole Hog Sports looked like whenever I took your job.
Yeah.
And it looks a whole lot different now with, I mean, at that point, it was basically just the website. And now we've got a magazine, we've got our podcasts, we've got the luncheons that we do that you're speaking at in September.
Yeah.
We appreciate you being here. This is fun for me.
It's great to be here. It's awesome.
So I want to start with just kind of college football in general. What are the things that, you know, what are the big storylines that you're watching as we get closer to kickoff?
You know, to me, it's how are the top, like, I would say maybe 7 to 8 teams doing in practices right now? And I'm just trying to keep track of injuries and stuff like that, because I think there's a lot of those teams that if they lose a guy or two in camp could change the complexity of everything. And I say that because of this. Here the last, like, 4 to 5 days, I know a lot of people probably don't keep up with it. They're focused on their singular team. There have been some big injuries at some big teams. Notre Dame just lost their left tackle. Nebraska's lost a left tackle. Texas, a legitimate SEC championship contender, just lost their running back, C.J. Baxter. But the good thing for Texas is they have another Doka Walk Award watch list running back. They're healthy next to him. So I kind of keep my eyes on that our first few weeks of camp. But when we go into this season, I think a lot of us, including myself, fans, everybody, I think it's not going to hit us till probably the last third of the season about how different this college football season is going to feel because of the playoff. You know, there's going to be so many teams still fighting for a playoff berth. I think a lot of these teams that are quote unquote in their conference races, either in the SEC or Big Ten, they're going to start diminishing the importance of the actual conference championship game. So, for example, like a Penn State used to be, if we don't win the Big Ten, we're probably not going to get in the playoff. Now, Penn State, which is, I think finished in the top 12 six times under James Franklin, but yet has never made the playoff because it was a 4-team playoff. Now, they're not going to be so worried about winning the Big Ten. It's just going to be, can we finish the season with 2 losses or less and get into the playoff? So, it's going to be interesting to see how some of these teams readjust their values late in the season. So, like Michigan, maybe a Big Ten contender, but maybe they're okay with not winning the Big Ten championship after losing to Ohio State near the end of the season because they're still getting into the playoff to make noise.
Here's a scenario for you. Let's say, I don't know, let's just say a team knows they're going to be in the playoff, but they're not going to be in their conference championship game. Do you foresee anything like where you maybe sit out some players similar to what you see in the late weeks of the NFL season?
There's been talk about that. I think, you know, a lot of coaches have tried to say that maybe they'd have some type of approach, much like the NBA. We talk about load bearing in the NBA, players only playing a certain amount of minutes each week. You could see that near the end of the season for some of these teams. If they realize, okay, we've got a playoff spot wrapped up, we're still contending for an SEC or Big Ten championship, and maybe we should take back. So, for example, our star defensive tackle, instead of playing him 54 snaps a game, much like Texas did with Byron Murphy last year, we take him down to 30 to 34. So we're saving 20 snaps each week for the last 2 weeks of the season so we can maybe play him actually more in the SEC championship game or whatever, or in the playoff itself. I don't know necessarily that we're going to see players straight up just sit out, that the coaches go, we're going to rest this guy, unless you're like maybe a Georgia that's completely run away and you've got like a 2-game lead going to the finals or final SEC game and you know that you're in the SEC championship. Maybe you do that. But I think a lot of these races at the top are going to be so close that you're not going to straight up see a lot of players sit out.
Because with the way the playoff works now, there's not that month turnaround to a bowl game now. It's
2 weeks.
2 weeks, right, after the end of the regular season.
Yeah, and then you – not only that, but then you got to play 3-4 games or whatever, and you're not getting more than, like, 7-8 days of rest. I say rest, but between games. But you also have to take into account that these teams are going to be traveling, you know, to these sites, usually about 2 days, I think – I don't know if they put out the official schedule yet, but I saw a leaked thing where they have to be there 2 days before kickoff. And they when they get there, not only are they doing walkthrough or a practice, they got like a half a day of media responsibilities they have to take advantage of. And then in addition to everything they're having to do there at the bowl site. So these players are not going to be getting a lot of rest and turnaround.
When do we get to the point, because we're at 12 playoff teams right now, I don't think anybody thinks that's where it's going to end. When do we get to the point, though, where let's say you're Ohio State and you're a top four seed and you don't have to play that first playoff weekend, but by not playing that first playoff weekend, you don't get a home game and you don't get that home gate from a playoff. At what point do those teams start making a fuss about that?
That's a possibility. I think what's even more interesting, but it goes along with that, is Notre Dame has agreed to – we will never get a first-round bye, ever. You have to be a conference champion to get a first-round bye, right, the way it's situated now. And they agreed to that with no, like, kickbacks of, like, some other thing. That's business decision, right? But as we know in college sports, emotions start getting involved in business decisions, whether it's firing coaches, hiring coaches. And I think at some point in the next few years – Notre Dame, potentially, if they could be in a spot where they're like, we're in the top four, but we're not gaining a first-round bye because we're not a conference champion, and it's putting a lot of load on our players, and at some point, maybe they're in the semifinal game and they lose on a field goal or they lose by one possession, and they go, you know what, if we just had that one extra week off, we could have made it the championship game or won the whole thing. Emotions will start getting involved, and I think very much so that could carry over to, like you said, like an Ohio State or whatever, and we talk about gate receipts. But also, I think a lot of this is going to come down to the teams that are dealing with injuries, that are trying to rest players, and all the workload that's going to be put on them.
I can't wait to see playoffs in winter weather in college football. Because, you know, like we see it in the NFL, not so much in the NFL because so many teams have gone to domed stadiums, but you do see it in certain places like Green Bay and Buffalo where the weather can really affect it. I mean, can you imagine South Bend in mid-December or – Columbus or Ann Arbor or, you know, Happy Valley. These would be really fun places to watch a playoff game. In 2020, when the season got changed because of COVID, you know, teams were playing later into December by the way the schedule. And so, like, Arkansas played – they played at Missouri on December 5th, and that one was brutally cold. But then Alabama came here on December 12th, and it wasn't much of a game. But I remember being at that game and they're playing Christmas music and it's like I don't know if there were snow flurries, but it was cold enough to snow. I mean, it was like a 36 degree day or something. And you're just sitting there thinking, man, I have never experienced anything like this. There's something about those extra 2 weeks that can really play with you from a weather standpoint.
You know, it's interesting. I was talking to some Big Ten teams a couple of weeks ago at their media days about the requirements by the playoff committee and structure that they are required to host a playoff game. And a lot of the questions for the Big Ten teams was winterizing your stadium. Is your stadium winterized? And I asked the Iowa AD, you know, what about your turf, your grass turf or whatever? I mean, you're going to be playing on a frozen tundra potentially. Do you have to have coils underneath your field? Are they requiring that or anything like that? And they're like, I don't even know if we have coils under our field. I'm like, well, I'm guessing you probably don't if you don't know. But, you know, the other thing is, I don't know if anybody will take advantage of this, but teams in the north, because of weather, if they say, hey, we don't want to play in cold weather, they can try and set up a neutral, not neutral site, but a game in a dome stadium somewhere if they can get it. So say you're Iowa and you don't want to play outside for whatever reason. If you can somehow get the Lucas Oil Stadium in Indianapolis, you can host there. If you're the host team, you can get that all set up. But I don't think anybody – you're going to want that weather advantage if you're a northern team, wouldn't you?
I would think so. You want home field advantage however you can get it. I want to talk to you about Arkansas some, but one more big story that I think affects the SEC potentially down the line is what's going on in the ACC right now with Clemson and Florida State and the lawsuit and, you know, potentially trying to get out of their ACC membership. What's going on there, and how do you think, if at all, this affects the SEC down the road? Because geographically they fit, but you wonder about – do you get pushback from Florida or from South Carolina, similar to what A&M didn't get a chance to push back against Texas? I think they tried at the 11th hour, and it was too late. But you would have a similar situation here if you had a Clemson or a Florida State come in.
The worst thing that Clemson and Florida State are doing right now is being public with all this. Because now it's Florida's on the ready. South Carolina's on the ready of, we don't want them. We don't want schools from within our own region, in our own state, coming in and taking up market value or whatever. So you've seen the reports. This has been, we've been hearing this for the last year, that the SEC and Big Ten right now are just not interested in adding either school in Clemson or Florida State. But the moment Clemson and Florida State hit the market, which is looking more and more likely, I can guarantee you those conferences will be interested. Whether they actually go and offer them a spot in their conferences and the whole other thing. Because right now, as Greg Sankey, the SEC commissioner, has said, right now we would just be splitting up the pie in more pieces. We wouldn't necessarily be getting more money, more value. But once those things spread out, work themselves out in the court system, I think that changes things from an ESPN perspective as far as what they would pay someone. Because remember, right now, ESPN, which pretty much owns everything now, they own the ACC network. They half own the SEC network. They're fully in bed with the SEC now as far as media rights. They're not with the Big Ten. The Big Ten's done its own thing with multiple networks. So a lot of that kind of has to come into play. But I can tell you right now, you know, the Florida State AD has told me and others that we're running out every ground ball right now, which is to say we're just doing everything we can and making sure we cover all our bases. So at the point we have to maybe pull the trigger and say we're leaving, they will do so. How they will do that financially is the big question, because no one wants to pay upwards to $500 million to leave a conference. There's potentially private equity that could get involved there to help, you know, offset some of that. But what they're hoping right now is by taking this all to courts that they'd be able to fight it and maybe get that number negotiated down at some point. But I still think we're probably a long ways away from that happening. And as it stands today, I think this will be something we talk about again and again, probably for the next, maybe up to the next 2 years.
Do you think the ACC and the Big 12, how long do you think they can ward off what feels like this imminent two-league, you know, super division?
I think that the playoff and what the playoff will look like beyond this year has a lot to play into that. And the reason why I say that is because it's 12 teams now. It's most likely going to go 16 next year. But a lot of that's going to depend on what the SEC and Big Ten want to do. So if, let's say, the SEC gets four teams into the playoff this year and does so under circumstances where, like, one of those teams is a three-loss team or something, and the Big Ten gets a similar number in similar circumstances, they're not probably going to want to change this to a 16-team playoff. They'll want to stick with 12. Now, if the opposite happens, they'll want to go to 16 so they can get more teams in. So if you end up not expanding the playoff further, I think you're putting a more of a stranglehold on the Big 12 and the ACC. You're limiting their options as it is. A lot of the talk right now is about how many automatic berths should we get. The SEC and Big 10 want three apiece. Big 12 will get two, so will the ACC. Big 12 loves that idea. They love getting two because, as one person told me, it's two more than we were getting. This season is going to be interesting to watch. If you are the Big 12 or ACC, you better hope that the Big 10 and SEC struggle to get three teams into the playoff.
How do you think Arkansas climbs the mountain in the SEC? What have they got to do to because it's tough. It's a tough climb. What have they got to do to position themselves better than they are right now?
Well, I'll say that. Personal anecdote. A lot of you are probably playing EA Sports College Football, right? My dynasty team is Arkansas because I'm a Razorback. I live here. And after the first season, I moved to the Big 12. That's what I did. I'm not saying Arkansas should do that, though. I think it in the old Big 12, it would have made sense. It wouldn't now.
Right.
What do you have to do? You know, as you know, Matt, the best Arkansas teams have always been the ones that have had the high-profile in-state Arkansas kids stay here at home. And they've always been able to mix that together with a great coach that does things a little bit differently. Whether it was Bobby Petrino in the past with all the receivers from Warren. Of course, you had Ryan Mallett coming back home after being at Michigan. Tyler Wilson. Darren McFadden previously under Houston Nutt. Felix Jones just across the border in Tulsa. Peyton Hillis down in Conway. those are when the best Arkansas teams are the best Arkansas teams. So the high school football's probably got to get a little bit better in the state right now.
Do you think high school football has to get better, or do you think the coaches have to be more willing to take some of the – because I don't know that – I think high school football may be as good as it's ever been in Arkansas, but what we're seeing is the coaches take fewer and fewer Arkansas players. I think it was 3 2 years ago and 5 last year. I don't know that the football has changed so much as maybe the attitude of the recruiters have.
Maybe so. I don't follow recruiting too closely. Like, for example, I know that I think it was a kid out of Little Rock that just went to Auburn, a quarterback, Walker White.
Walker White, yep.
I know that just from my ties.
Legacy player at Arkansas.
Yeah, and I know him from my ties at Auburn. And you're right, there have been great players at Arkansas in the state for a long, long time. You got to keep them in here. You've also just got to mix that right with the right type of coach who's going to do things maybe a little bit differently, especially in this day and age. I don't know if there's a lot of coaches out there that can just simply out-scheme other coaches anymore in the SEC, because at this point it's almost like talent just wins out at the end of the day most times out of not in the SEC these days. It's not like, you know, I hate to say it, like you look back in 2010 Arkansas, right? Very talented team, right? Very talented team. Is that a team that's maybe a loss or two worse without Bobby Petrino? Yes.
Probably.
Yeah. Absolutely. But also, you saw how close they were to maybe making even more noise. They were in it against Auburn on the road that year when Auburn went to the national championship and won it. They lost in overtime. I was covering Mississippi State at the time, the beat writer. They lost to Mississippi State in overtime in a game that Arkansas beat Mississippi State. But there were these close games where, you know, either way, like Petrino's not the coach on the sideline. Mississippi State probably wins that game. So, but nowadays, you're not seeing those games where you're going, they won that game because that coach made that call in the SEC. Like, how many times we sit there and go, what a marvelous job by Nick Saban deciding to call a three-man. I mean, you don't hear that,
right,
even under the GOAT. It's just always the talent seems to be winning out day in and day out.
I was talking to Houston Nutt at the 7A state championship last year between Fayetteville and Bentonville, and you can think what you want to about Houston, but he did have success here. And so I think that, you know, what he says, it's interesting. And he said, I never wanted to have a class where I had fewer than 12 to 14 players from Arkansas. And his philosophy was that you get the players from Arkansas and two things happen. Number one, they tell the players who come in from out of state what it's like to be a Razorback, what, you know, just what this means. And I think there's some validity to that. And he said, number two, what happens is they stick with you. And he used Dan Doty as an example of a guy who he brought in who was not recruited at all. But by the end of his career, he was a really good offensive lineman on a team that I think won 9 games. And I think that's what they're missing right now. They're missing the Brandon Burlsworth type players because they're just not getting those opportunities anymore unless they want to come in and redshirt and walk on.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, I even think back, God, who was the tight end for the 98 team?
Jodine Davenport.
Yeah, Jodine Davenport. Guys like that. I think there is something to do that. And you also look across the SEC. You know, everybody just kind of thinks that, you know, Alabama and Georgia, they're just recruiting nationally. Well, yeah, that too. But Georgia's keeping their home state talent in the state. Alabama's doing the same. And right now, Nick Saban has left Alabama, as we know right now. So, but in that state, Auburn has swooped in and they've signed or they've got commitments from 8 of their top 10 in-state talent there. That hasn't been done since Tommy Tuberville was there. Nick Saban's dominated that, and the other two players are going to Ohio State right now, and Auburn's still trying to flip them. Meanwhile, Alabama's kind of going, well, let's go get some kids from Tennessee or Ohio or California or whatever. But at some point, if you keep doing that, that your core, your in-state core, as you said, the guys that understand what that what Alabama means to that state and everything, I think that hurts you. Can you imagine if Georgia just said, let's stop getting all these big-time defensive linemen from around Atlanta and everything. Let's just keep recruiting nationally. That's going to rot you from the inside out a little bit. And I agree with you. If there are enough players in the state of Arkansas where that you feel like they can play SEC ball or play SEC ball, I should say, within for the first 3 years of them being on campus, you need to go get them. Every school that's been successful, it does so with successful in-state talent.
We may circle back around to some football talk here real quick, but because I know you covered this, the shock level of John Calipari to Arkansas.
Yeah, it was insane. You know, we started hearing all those rumors and everything, and Wes Moore, you know, broke that story down in Little Rock. And I remember contacting my boss going, I know some people, can I work this even though I do football a little bit? And he's like, go for it, see what you can get. And I got a couple of things, and I couldn't believe it was happening. And here we are. It's I think Arkansas fans need to prepare them, and probably they might already understand this. I'm sure they probably do. Arkansas is about to be the villain in basketball nationally. Used to be Duke or North Carolina and everything, but those coaches are gone. Coach K is gone. The, you know, the stigma, the Duke Blue Devil and all that stuff, that kind of evokes some type of emotional response still, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's the coaches that usually stoke that out of you in basketball.
Especially now, because nobody stays anywhere for more than a year or two.
Exactly right. So John Calipari has become the guy in the center of the target across the country for fans. And I think a lot of probably Arkansas fans don't realize this, but you realize there's a lot of attention about Arkansas now. Like, so for example, like, I'm on YouTube all the time. Like, I go watch something that's about live, and whenever it's about John Calipari in Arkansas, it's amazing the amount of views that stuff's getting.
Yeah.
And that's not Arkansas fans watching that, guys. That's a lot of fans hate watching it because they hate Calipari, and they hate what Arkansas is doing right now. So the Razorbacks, wherever they go on the road this year, it's going to be a sellout, and it's going to be an absolute pandemonium. Everybody's going to be out to get Arkansas this year. And if I was an Arkansas fan, which I am, relish it, because this is going to be awesome to watch these next few years.
And we were talking about Joe Klein with it the other, or about this the other day. He, Calipari's hire has completely changed the perception of Arkansas basketball. They had taken a step up with Musselman, and now they've taken a huge step. I don't even know if you can say it's one step. It's they've gone up the ladder from a national standpoint. We got to talk more with Brandon here in a minute. I'm going to talk to you about the house case because this is a big deal.
Yeah.
But we'll be back in just a moment.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
And welcome back here in our downtown Fayetteville studio. I keep showing you this every day. Christina Long, give her a lot of credit, our editor of Hogs Illustrated, for having this thought to do an Olympic preview of the Razorbacks. Rosé Stona, the latest Razorback to medal in the Paris Olympics. He threw, I think, 70 meters in the discus. It was an Olympic record yesterday in Paris. He wins the gold medal in the discus, and that's an upset. It was a big upset for him to win that. And what I think is interesting is that Ryan Krauser, who had won the gold medal in the shot put earlier in the week, he is Stona's coach. So that's kind of like two gold medals for Ryan Krauser. You can check out Hogs Illustrated, 20 issues a year. Like we said, we've got special issues like this Olympic issue. We've got a football preview. You can see it over my shoulder. Basketball preview, baseball preview, a recruiting issue. We're about to get into our weekly magazines as football season starts. 20 issues, complete access to all of our content at wholehogsports.com. Monthly subscriptions begin at $17. You can go to hogsillustrated.com/subscribe or call 479-684-5509 to learn more about Hogs Illustrated. Brandon Marcello joining us for a second segment. He is a college football reporter for 24/7 Sports. And we had Ross Dellinger on earlier this week, a friend of yours, and you know, I don't know that people are talking enough about this House versus NCAA settlement. This is a huge deal. When I was in grad school, I don't know how they let me get away with this, but I did my thesis on the 1984 Supreme Court case.
Oh, gosh.
And how it affected conference realignment. And basically, I put an Arkansas angle on it because Arkansas was the first team to go from one major conference to another after that Supreme Court case. That's the biggest – that and Title IX are the two biggest pieces of – legislation, if you will, or legal rulings that have affected college sports. This is not far behind.
Yeah.
And I don't know that people really understand what we're looking at just in terms of, obviously they know there's the revenue share, 20 million plus at Power Four schools per year. The scholarship situation is one that really fascinates me because what's happened is numbers have been given. You know, you can have 34 baseball players, you can have 105 football players. And I think there's maybe a misconception by some people that, well, that means that there's going to be 105 football scholarships. That means there's going to be 34 baseball scholarships. Because of Title IX, because of budgetary concerns, I don't know that that's going to be the case.
I think that the big thing here is that the Title IX issue doesn't necessarily being applied by people behind the scenes to the revenue sharing aspect of it. What they're really looking at right now is how does this affect scholarships? So a lot of people, a lot of administrators out there think that they can just split the scholarships 50-50 among men and women, and that'll be enough to satisfy some Title IX laws. And the idea is that as a result, the revenue sharing will split it the way the revenue's coming in now. So football and men's basketball get the bulk of the money, generating the most money anyway. So we'll split most of the money with them and then give the rest to the other athletes based depending on the type of revenue they're bringing in off the media contracts. But the other big issue there is a lot of people want some type of federal legislation to kind of protect them from that. So they're not getting all these other lawsuits mm-hmm. on the books. The problem is that's just, you're just probably not going to get that federal protection right now. A lot of it's going to depend on how the presidential election runs out because that affects how the House and the Senate and all that stuff settles out as well. Mm-hmm. So in the meantime, the prevailing thought out there, especially from Jeffrey Kessler, who's the lead plaintiff attorney in this whole House case, he believes that this is going to be settled school by school in the courtroom potentially. So by that, I mean, you're probably not going to hear the SEC say, okay, this is our plan. 50% of the scholarships have to go to these athletes, 50% here, and you have to share the revenue this way. It's going to be a school-by-school decision that's maybe steered by the SEC and their colleagues and discussing things. But what was probably going to arise from that are individual lawsuits potentially at every school that are going to challenge those decisions. So, for example, if for some reason one school goes, all right, we're going to do 50-50 scholarships to men and women, but we're also going to do 50-50 revenue, you're going to have lawsuits from football and men's basketball players saying, hey, we generate the most money. Why aren't we getting more of the money? And vice versa. You're going to have lawsuits from women's athletes or from athletes from the other smaller sports against the other. So I don't think this is necessarily going to end anytime soon. It's just going to be one of those things where a lot of these schools are just going to have to jump in the deep end and figure out how to swim as they sink.
You said conferences, you don't think they're going to get involved, but from a standpoint of fairness, one thing I wonder about, what happens if Georgia says we're going to fund 105 football scholarships, but Tennessee says we can only fund 97, or baseball. Let's say LSU says we're going to fund 34 baseball scholarships, but Mississippi State says we're only going to fund 27. Does the conference step in there and try to give some guidance on scholarship limits?
I don't think so, because they've already set that nationally among the Power Four. This is what we agreed on. You can have up to 105 scholarship athletes. It's up to the individual schools now to decide whether they can fund that.
This is fascinating.
So you're going to have some inequities there from school to school. And again, I think this is going to come down to a school-by-school situation. And maybe years down the line, there will be a situation where they go, this is unruly. We have to have the conferences do conference-wide rules on the individual instead of us doing individually right now. Based off because what you're doing is you're just going, all right, everybody has to live in this same neighborhood. Figure out a way to pay for your house.
There's a lot of that going on right now, by
yes.
the way. But from a baseball standpoint, I know you don't cover baseball anymore, but you have a little bit within the framework of this house settlement. You've been here at Arkansas. You've been at Mississippi State. You know how big of a deal it is on some campuses. The 34 scholarships is interesting to me because, again, we go back to, I think a lot of people think there are going to be 34 baseball scholarships, and that's probably not going to be the case. I added it up at Arkansas that if you took Arkansas's 8 men's sports and you took their 11 women's sports and you applied the maximum scholarship total you could to each one, the 8 men's sports would have 18 more scholarships than the 11 women's sports. So something's going to have to give somewhere because that's not going to fly from a Title IX standpoint. Where do you think the baseball scholarships end up? And knowing full well that it could vary from campus to campus, we had Ross Dellinger on earlier this week. He said he thought somewhere in the mid-20s. Kendall Rogers wrote something for D1 Baseball yesterday. He said he thought, and this was based on talking with SEC coaches, somewhere 23 to 25 in the SEC. But again, I guess we don't really know, do we? This is baseball is fascinating to me, Brandon, if I can make a point, because you look at like men's tennis and women's tennis, it's the same number. Men's track, women's track, it's the same number. Golf, basketball, there's no one-to-one comparison for baseball. Everybody wants to lump baseball and softball together, as if they are the same sport. They're not the same sport. Mm-hmm. Baseball's got to have a lot more arms, a lot more pitchers than softball teams do.
You're exactly right. And then also, you just look at it from a number standpoint. We talk about 105 scholarships for football. You know, they're increasing that, but you're going to, from what was the, is it 11 point or 13
11.
Point?
11.7 for baseball.
7 for baseball. All the way up to 34. That's like you're tripling.
J.J. Cooper at Baseball America said that if every school added 22.3 baseball scholarships, it would be somewhere between $1 million and $1.2 million per school per year.
That's a lot of money, and it doesn't sound like it when you're an SEC school, but that stuff adds up at SEC schools, especially when you have to increase scholarships and also revenue share with these other sports. But you're exactly right. I don't think you're going to see a lot of schools. In fact, I would say the vast majority are not going to go up to 34. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be able to fund that right now because the number game also. They're probably going to do a 50-50 split, and you got to give some to the women's athletes to get that 50-50 split. You can't just go, all right, we're going to do 34 in baseball and do 20 in softball. Mm-hmm. And then you're trying to play a number game there. Also, I just don't think a lot of schools are going to want to put down that type of money. I've talked to several West Coast schools where I just straight up asked them, I go, are you going to fund 34 scholarships? And they went, no, mm-hmm. we're just not going to do that. And that's just at face value as it is now. Not even talking about the competitive level and all that stuff. What is going to be fascinating to see is that a year or two into this is how public are the schools going to make their numbers known so that other people recruiting against them know, well, Arkansas is offering 32 scholarships.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Vanderbilt's offering 22 with these other academic scholarships. You know, Mississippi State's doing 32. How public is that stuff going to be? There's going to be ways to find that out at the end of the year when they're reporting like revenues and all this stuff. But there's going to be quite a bit of cat and mouse being played here among the schools and recruiting.
I was talking to somebody last night just about how far in advance college teams like to plan. I mean, like you see football games scheduled 12, 13 years in advance, right? This is such a rapid development that they are going to have to get their arms around because this is going to go into place by next August.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got to get some things figured out before then. November 8th is the early signing date for every sport but football. And none of those coaches know what their scholarship limits are going to be for the players that they're trying to get commit to them and sign in 3 months.
Yeah, it's insane. And I will say this, that you know, I do think in a lot of ways the pandemic year has prepared them for this vast amount of change and mm-hmm. quick have to think on your feet yeah. quickly. That helps, you know, as crazy as that sounds as well. But, you know, also there are some people out there that think that this whole thing is going to get delayed till 2026 in August
really?
2026. No one is saying that publicly, but a lot of people are going, how are we going to get this all done? Like, how are we going to mm-hmm. do it? But it's probably going to have to be done just legally. And it's going to put a lot of schools in some very tight situations trying to figure this all out. I mean, you're asking not just to figure out the number game of it, but also everything you set right now is going to set yourself up for potential for litigation
mm-hmm.
and to be sued and all this stuff. And you've got to figure this all out in the next like 8 months, you know, really before you go into the summer months to figure this all out. Nothing like this has ever been undertaken in college athletics. And for that matter, I would say in any sport in America where they've said, we're going to not only change the entire system, we're going to change the way you do business, and you have to put it all instituted for your 19-plus sports
mm-hmm.
On a vast scale. And then also, you know, not to say some athletic directors and presidents saw this coming, but some of them have been preparing, saving up money over the mm-hmm. last 5-6 years for the potential of revenue sharing. I shouldn't say revenue sharing. At the time, they thought that maybe they have to pay players
right.
as employees. And that's a whole other thing. Should we signify these players as employees? As much as like a lot of us hate talking about this and hearing about it, because it's just a lot of it's numbers flying over our heads, hypotheticals mm-hmm. and all this stuff. And everybody just wants to see the football games played and the basketball games played. It's going to change the way we see the sports and how they're played here in the next 2 to 3 years. You're going to see that fallout on the field because you're going to see if this becomes a situation where a Georgia's funding 105 scholarships and a Mississippi State's only funding 85 or whatever, that gap, talent gap on the field is only going to expand further. And that's gonna hurt the sport a little bit.
And that's not just football. That's every sport.
Exactly right.
Brandon, we're going to have to leave it there. Appreciate you being in here this morning.
Yeah,
it's
thank
great
you.
Seeing you.
Yeah, good to see you.
All right, we'll be back with Tom Murphy in just a moment here on our podcast.
At Kendall King, we're proud of over 4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kindle King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are Design.
And welcome back in. We appreciate you being here. Tom Murphy from the Arkansas Democrat Gazette is with us. We want to tell you that our show is brought to you in part by Bentonville Glass, committed, professional, versatile, serving its community since 1971. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass. All your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can go by and see them at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. So as we record this, Arkansas is going through its first preseason football scrimmage of the year. Tom, what are you expecting to hear whenever you talk to Sam Pittman about this a little bit later?
Well, that's a good question. Since we're not viewing it, we are told what they did on the field today. And I'm trying to think back to last year. I think they was maybe a little disappointed in the run game early on in camp. And I think he'll be pretty honest. They'll tell us who scored touchdowns and what the run game, what the pass game looked like, Taylen Green, so on and so forth. But just looking at this from the highest 30,000 feet deal, man, I'm like, if you're an Arkansas fan, what do you want to hear? That they're improved, right? What does it mean to be improved? So many things can go into how are you improved. And it just starts with, like, if you're building a pyramid, being together and believing in your schemes and believing in your teammates, are they better in those departments? I think with Bobby Petrino on offense, they are. Defensively, can they make strides from last year? That's the big question to me. Can they make big strides? When you replace so many of your linebackers, there's a lot of learning to catch up to. But all the vibes in camp are that they're a closer team, that they trust their teammates, and, you know, that could make a difference on the field in these close games, which the whole narrative of Arkansas is if you win close games the last couple of years, you have a different record.
But don't we hear this every preseason?
You hear it from every camp, even Vanderbilt is talking about. Yeah. They are improved, they are together.
That's what the preseason is about, is accentuating the positives. And what happens is that when I don't want to sound like I'm bashing access, because it's up to every coach to do what they want to do. But when you can't get in there and see more than 20 minutes a day, and those 20 minutes typically are not one-on-one type situations, you just don't really know what to expect until the season kicks off. And then, you know, Christina and I were talking about this a couple of days ago. Arkansas always say they play UAPB the first game. So we really don't know what we're going to get from Arkansas, I don't think, until September 7th. That's going to be the first time that you really get a good glimpse of what this team might look like.
Well, I think you make a good point there, Matt, that, yeah, the Oklahoma State game on the road, week two, is where we're going to learn a lot more about them. I don't think they're going to reveal a whole lot special in the UAPB game, so they can spring it on Oklahoma State, so to speak. But you do learn some things in camp. And I do think from the top, it feels like the players have more of a trust factor and a belief factor in what they're doing. Now, how they react when they get punched in the mouth and they have to come back from two touchdowns down, that's when we're going to really see if they've made improvements.
I thought at SEC Media Days, one of the most fascinating parts of it was listening to Saban when he was on SEC Network. And one of the things that he mentioned was your coordinators are like your second lieutenants. And he said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, it's really not a big deal when you lose a wide receiver coach or running backs coach. If your coordinators are the same, you feel good about it, you know, a carryover from the year before. Obviously, Arkansas wants things to change on offense because of what happened last year. Petrino as a coordinator, I wonder how you have seen that maybe change the, I don't know, feeling within the team.
Well, on the field through the spring and the early parts of camp, you don't hear him as much as you used to when he was the head coach. I mean, he would get on to defensive guys regularly between 2008 and 2011. Now it's, you know, a little more subdued. I think he kind of understands what his role is supposed to be, and he's probably happier because Jimbo Fisher at A&M last year did not allow him to use his own verbiage.
He's taking the handcuffs off.
And now his handcuffs are off. I think Sam Pittman's probably said, look, this is going to be your offense, your calls. We're going to fit our blocking schemes in, and I'm going to apply myself more toward the blocking schemes and helping improve individually up front. you give us the schemes and the calls, and that's probably freed up Bobby Petrino's mind, and I think we're seeing that displayed on the field.
Granted that you don't see a lot of one-on-one, what have you thought of Taylen Green?
Okay. I think a completion percentage standpoint, so he was in the high 50s maybe at Boise. It's going to be hard in the SEC to – I just think that they need to have enough so-called easy short throws to help him get confidence up game by game. And he's going to have to make smart decisions on when he sees that things are broken down and runs. And if he can do that, then somebody's not getting open. Okay, well, I scramble for six or seven, then you've helped yourself. So his touchdown to interception ratio, we're going to have to keep an eye on. And how well receivers get open, I asked Ronnie Fauch about this specifically. He feels like in the Petrino schemes, everything's so coordinated, all the routes are so precise that Taylen should know where his windows are, and that will help him. But to me, that is a big question about this team, whether Taylen Green can be as efficient and his completion percentage up there high enough to be competitive in games.
You see this in all different sports. Players who they go into a new setting and they get a new way of coaching and they become a different player. And I think that's going to be so important for Arkansas this year. If Taylen Green plays like he played at Boise last year, I don't think that's going to be good enough for Arkansas. It wasn't good enough at Boise. I mean, he lost his starting job four or five games into the season. They went to a two-quarterback system, and he got it back after the quarterback that he was playing with got hurt, and he played well at the end of the year, to his credit. But that's the most fascinating thing to me this year is how does he take to this new way of coaching? Every indication we've got is that, you know, he's good with Petrino in the film room. He's good. He's doing everything that Petrino's wanting him to do. But how does that translate to game day? That's going to be the biggest deal for this team.
One of the biggest questions that the team will face is how he produces. And you know what will really help him is if they're good in the run game. If they're good in the run game, that will take so much pressure off him feeling like he has to be pretty perfect in the pass game. But I'll say this for Taylen Green. I think he understands the culture in Arkansas. And, you know, being from Texas, he's, you know, from this region of the country. And he's adapted so well to being, quote, the face of the program, you know, in his NIL opportunities, in engagement with the community, and the things he's done. So I think he's kind of ready for that mantle of everyone's looking at me. And to talk to Landon Jackson yesterday, he and Landon are kind of being co-like leaders in the clubhouse and understanding the offense and defense have to be tighter than it was last year, and there's a value in that.
Here's a kind of a loaded question. You're an AP voter, top 25 voter. We saw the coaches poll come out the other day. There were seven teams that Arkansas plays this year who were ranked in the top 20. As you kind of evaluate who they're playing, keeping that in mind, there can be teams that improve year over year, but maybe they don't improve more than the teams that they're playing. You know what I mean? How do you balance that with Arkansas, knowing that this is probably going to be an improved football team from last year? I think we all expect them to be. I think we think the defense could be at least on par with what they were last year, and we expect the offense to be better. How do you balance that with the schedule that they play?
Well, it's always tough with Arkansas. Since I've been covering the team, they've had the number one toughest schedule many times back when they were playing Alabama every year. And now they don't play Bama, but they're playing a team that's ranked higher in the preseason poll than Alabama, which is Texas by one spot. I would say this. They played that series of close games early in the season. It was LSU, Bama, and Ole Miss all in a row.
And BYU.
And so A&M was in there, but A&M won by 12. Mm-hmm. But so when they get into the close games, if they're able to give Auburn a really good run and be in the game late like they were in the 2020, and they find a way to pull that out, that's how you start judging whether they're better.
Tom, we appreciate you being here. You can read all of Tom's coverage about Razorback football at wholehogsports.com or in the Arkansas or Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. We'll be back tomorrow. We believe we'll have David Basil on tomorrow to talk about the Little Rock Touchdown Club lineup. He's got another great lineup this season. We're also going to talk to Jay Black. He is the curator for the Texas Sports Hall of Fame, which means that he oversees the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame. The SWC Hall of Fame is going to induct new membership next week, including Oliver Miller, the Razorback great basketball player. Be kind of interesting to talk to him about that museum and how they determine their new inductees. We appreciate you joining us today. Hope you'll join us at WholeHogSports.com. Until tomorrow, have a great day, everyone.